Hello everyone, welcome to Appleby Asia Talks. My name is Bronwyn King. I'm a partner in the investment funds team in the Hong Kong office of Appleby. Appleby Asia Talks is intended to cover interesting and pertinent points that we come across in discussions with clients, and wherever possible, we try to keep the conversation concise. Today we'll be talking about offshore management companies, and I'll be joined by my colleague Mark Parrott. The purpose of this conversation is to provide our thoughts on the issues pertaining to offshore management companies and when and where they may be an appropriate vehicle in your fund structure. This conversation does not constitute legal advice. Hi, Mark. We've had a couple of conversations recently around the change in the ability to use offshore management companies in connection with offshore funds over the last few years. And I think there are a few interesting aspects to this topic. Let's talk a little about the reasons for this change.
Hi, Bronwyn. Indeed, this is certainly something where we've seen significant change over the last 3 years or so, I suppose. And, you know, obviously the initial driver of this was the introduction in the offshore jurisdictions of what's come to be known as the economic substance regime. Really an initiative of the OECD to target what they refer to as base erosion and profit shifting, or effectively moving revenues away from onshore taxable jurisdictions and into lower tax offshore jurisdictions. Now, that had a sort of significant impact on the ability to use offshore management companies without those companies complying with significant economic substance tests, and that's sort of led, I suppose, to the use of different structures in certain cases, and in certain cases simply the removal of, you know, offshore management companies.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So in 2018, the International Tax Cooperation Economic Substance Act was promulgated, and we saw that it targeted relevant entities that were companies, became partnerships as well, LLCs, that were carrying out relevant activities. And amongst the relevant activities, in addition to banking business, headquarter business, IP business, shipping business, distribution and service centres, was fund management business. And so we saw a scrambling of our clients either putting in sufficient economic substance in the Cayman Islands or alternatively restructuring their investment funds. Now, from my vantage point, I think the industry that was most hit really was the hedge fund industry, because it was so commonly used in a hedge fund structure merely as a parking vehicle. So, you know, the typical structure was fund delegating investment management to the Cayman fund manager, and then that would delegate investment advisory to an onshore regulated fund advisory entity. And there would be a cost plus analysis applied, and the management fee and the performance fee would be paid to the fund manager. So it was really acting as a parking vehicle for the 2 and 20 fee. But I didn't really see it utilized so much in the private equity, venture capital, infrastructure, real estate space. I guess that's because in the whole, those structures were used, the relevant structure was a partnership. And so you already had that inbuilt mechanism via the Cayman general partner, or alternatively the special limited partner that took carry and the fee. So, you know, that parking aspect wasn't as relevant. Is that something that you saw as well?
I agree with that. I agree, you know, in the first instance, those changes around fund management companies impacts hedge funds to a greater degree. Funds undertaking more liquid trading strategies. And I think, you know, part of that is, as you say, the use of a GP or GPLP, you know, structure has an entirely different sort of outcome. And I think that's a whole topic in itself, and we'll probably discuss that a little bit more as we go on here. But in addition, you know, when you have a hedge fund, you know, you're doing a lot of trading, and the trading is actually occurring, you know, at the onshore manager. You know, there's people at desks with Bloomberg machines putting trades into the market, you know, multiple times a day. And in circumstances where you're doing that, you've got to get management discretion into your onshore entity, your onshore management entity. So in order to do that, the offshore manager has to be a manager, because it becomes a manager and it delegates, you know, sub-management effectively to the onshore entity, so that trading can occur. If you're talking about funds with illiquid strategies, PE, VC, real estate, etc., they don't trade very regularly. So if you set it up where your offshore manager isn't actually a manager, it's an offshore advisor, it then can delegate advisory services to the onshore entity, and the onshore is an advisor, and the onshore advisor, you know, runs around and finds deals and does due diligence and negotiates purchase agreements and negotiates financing and effectively sort of gets a deal to the point that it is a viable transaction, and it can then advise that this is a transaction that we advise the fund should enter into, and they can pass that advice to the, you know, to the intermediate, we'll call it an offshore advisor now, and then the offshore advisor can pass that advice to the fund, and whether if the fund is, you know, GP, as you say, or it's the board of the GP. But even if the fund is a company or a segregated portfolio company, again, you're giving it to the board. And because that Cayman company is an advisor rather than a manager, you also got into that distinction. There was sort of this distinction as to the sort of economic substance capturing fund management business, but not capturing investment advisory services. And that seems a very sort of very fine line. But it was a fine line that, for economic substance, you know, kept those offshore advisors out of it.
Mm.
And again, in PE and VC and so on, either you weren't using, you know, any sort of offshore manager / advisor, or it was much more likely that it was an advisor rather than a manager. And so it sort of stayed out, you know, for that reason.
Absolutely. The other distinction too is that it was much easier to build an economic substance for those types of vehicles if they were undertaking investment management, because they may not be doing many trades, and so the decision making could be put into the Cayman Islands through the majority of the board sitting in the Cayman Islands, decisions being made in the Cayman Islands, and etc.
I guess that's right. And I think you raise a really interesting point, which I think people do need to sort of understand, is this idea of economic substance not just being a cost. It isn't just something that, oh, we can pay some money to a service provider and they can, you know, provide us some, you know, substance solution, and it's as simple as that. No matter how you come at this, you know, as you say, sort of this idea of core income generating activities needing to occur in the Cayman Islands or the BVI or whatever offshore jurisdiction you're talking about really affects your investment process.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have this real willingness to bring effectively a service provider into, you know, your investment process. And it's not, oh, at the end of every quarter or semi-annual or something, you get on the phone with some directors in the, you know, Cayman Islands, and they ask you a few questions about what's been going on and is everything okay, and you sort of say, yes, everything's fine, and then everyone says, okay, well, we have exercised our fiduciary oversight, you know, that's good enough. It's they're going to literally be there, you know, in real time, you know, making or being a part of these investment decisions, and that's a big process change, right?
For super sensitive,
you know. So the idea of people sort of complying with economic substance, I think, has been the exception rather than the rule.
Yes.
I think far more commonly people have found ways not to have to become subject to economic substance.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, another way that we haven't discussed really is being tax resident in an onshore or midshore jurisdiction. Here in Hong Kong, that's rife with issues on the basis that 100% of your income needs to be taxed in that onshore, midshore tax jurisdiction, and that's not typically the case here. So what we've been seeing really is Cayman managers in particular just coming out of the structure and either you know, a non-discretionary investment advisor coming into the structure, or alternatively, you know, asset managers just completely doing away with the Cayman manager. That is increasingly likely now that we're seeing SEMA drilling down and undertaking significant material audits in the Cayman Islands. But there seems to be a winner in the offshore jurisdiction space and in this space, and that's the BVI. It's a really interesting evolution, actually, because in 2010, when the BVI promulgated the Securities Investment Business Act following the GFC, they bumped up the licensing regime for the investment managers and investment advisors, and it hit the market and it was pretty unpopular. And as a result of that, the BVI promulgated a new regulatory light product called the BVI Approved Manager. And it's been the big winner since the economic substance legislation has been issued. What are you seeing in that space?
Absolutely. It has been a clear beneficiary of all of this. It's so anomalous. It is a mystery to me as to why the BVI Approved Manager continues to be able to operate in the way that it does. And by that I mean, obviously outside of what constitutes fund management business for the purpose of the BVI economic substance regime. It's an entity undertaking exactly the same functions in exactly the same way and exactly the same structure, and yet it has entirely different outcome under economic substance. And the industry has rapidly become aware of that and engaged in, regulatory arbitrage of using, a BVI-approved manager to sort of wholly replace what would have historically been a, Cayman SIB Act manager. Mm-hmm. I do wonder, whether that is something that is going to, continue to be the case, indefinitely. And my personal view is sort of it's only a matter of time. But, at least for the time being, it does appear to be sort of, flying under the radar. And I'm seeing, a reasonable number of clients who are, using it, even in the full knowledge that it's probably only an interim solution.
Mm. Perhaps just to clarify for the listeners, the BVI has a licensed investment manager regime, and any manager that has a full investment business license to provide the services of fund management is required to comply with the economic substance regime in the BVI, unless it's exempt from doing so, for example, where it's tax resident in another jurisdiction. However, that regime does not impose requirements on BVI approved managers to implement economic substance on the basis that it doesn't hold a full investment business license. Instead, it's subject to regulation, but it's a significantly lighter regulatory regime, and it's aimed primarily to attract emerging managers, which is why there are some restrictions on the activities of an approved manager that you ought to know about. For instance, fund managers of open-ended funds, like hedge funds, are restricted to an aggregate AUM threshold of 400 million, whereas fund managers of closed-ended funds, like private equity and venture capital, are restricted to an aggregate AUM threshold of $1 billion. There are serious consequences if you breach these limits, so tracking AUM across your platform is absolutely critical.
You're absolutely right when you talk about this idea of something being for emerging managers. And if you were sort of facing the North American market and you were talking about restrictions of AUM on 400 million for open-ended funds and $1 billion for closed-ended funds, somebody might look at you and go, oh, that sounds a bit restrictive. But I think in Asia, the perspective would be very different on whether those caps are at all problematic, right? Yeah.
So where are you seeing them being used and why? I mean, is there an onshore manager or advisor in the structure for the funds that you're structuring with the BVI approved manager?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, with one exception. I mean, they're really just used as an analog of exactly what you would have seen for, the 10 or 20 years prior of people using a Cayman. It's an intermediary manager or advisor that sits between the, you know, the fund, the Cayman, you know, Cayman or BVI fund, and the onshore manager advisor. It's
sure.
Exactly as you say, it's an interim vehicle for, in the main, you know, fee structuring.
Mm. I mean, so mainly then just for corporate entities, because, I mean, if you had a GPLP, you wouldn't bother, would you?
The only circumstance where I'm seeing people use, continuing to want to use the BVI approved manager, and again, you know, I'm sitting in Hong Kong, I'm seeing people with funds managing crypto who basically cannot use an onshore regulated entity because of the SFC's regime around, you know, management of digital assets. Getting the SFC license is a science standard. And again, this is not Hong Kong legal advice. Mm. Yeah, I'm not a Hong Kong legal advisor, but, you know, what I hear is that it's very difficult. It takes a long time.
Absolutely.
And so on. So I'm seeing that. I think you raise an interesting point with, you know, with this GPLP point. And I've often thought, exactly as you say, why would you want to have an offshore manager, an offshore advisor? You've already got a GP. Now, obviously, there is this, you know, there's the technical issue around, well, a general partner has joint and several unlimited liability for mm-hmm. the debts and obligations of the partnership, mm-hmm. and accordingly, you don't want the GP to become a deep pocket, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
And people talk about that, and they say, oh, yes, but what we want to do is, you know, the GP pays these management fees or anything that it receives, well, it immediately pays them across to the, you know, to the Cayman manager, the separate, you know, manager, to get it away from the GP mm. and away from, you know, being a deep pocket. But if you simply had, you know, the GP owned by another offshore holdco, and any time you received any money into the GP,
you distribute it.
You just dividend it up,
mm.
and you're not creating a deep pocket at the GP level. So for me, I agree. I've never really seen it as being, you know, it's clear that that's necessary in
yeah,
the structure. But, you know, notwithstanding that, sort of, you know, it was somewhat common that people would do it. You know,
yeah,
maybe a part of it is you might run multiple funds over time, and then you've got this management entity that you can sort of point to as the track record of this management company mm-hmm. is X. Whereas your GP, you know, your strict GP entity might come and go kind of with each fund. I mean, think things like that. I mean,
I hear you. I'm just thinking, if we're talking about future proofing, and nobody knows how long that approved manager regime is going to float under the radar, then I don't feel so comfortable structuring a fund where my client is really interested in building a track record in that BVI approved manager.
I agree.
You know, if it's going to fall away as soon as the EU comes and reviews the BVI,
I agree.
You know, we're all assuming it's going to do.
I agree. And I think inherently a GPLP structure has become a much better structure than a corporate structure in the sense that, you know, a limited partnership structure, you already have your GP there.
Mm.
It's not required to be registered with CIMA or the BVI FSC. Accordingly, it's not subject to any regulation as a security, you know, from a securities regulatory perspective. As a result of that, it stays outside of economic substance. It also stays outside of, you know, as you alluded to earlier, you know, in Cayman, where CIMA is doing a lot of compliance audits and questionnaires and a little bit more heavy-handed regulatory. You know, the GP is just floats outside all of that.
Mm.
You know, whereas if you've got a fund structure as a company with another company there, all of a sudden it's caught by all of that, you know.
Yep, and all that regulatory overlay.
So it's a real distinction now, and it doesn't.
I think we were having a chat too about, you know, ensuring that our listeners appreciate that when we're talking about economic substance for investment management companies, it's clear that we're not talking about investment funds. And I know this is a passion of yours to ensure that our clients are sufficiently clear on that important distinction.
Absolutely. an absolute passion. you know, funds in the modern era where, you know, we have the FATCA regime and the Common Reporting Standard regimes, automatic exchange of information tax regimes, onshore tax regulators around the world have absolute transparency into who the owners of offshore funds, of interest in offshore funds are, and what the size of those interests is, and so on. So the idea that anybody is achieving really sort of any opaque tax outcomes or the like by investing into offshore funds, it's just simply unrealistic in the modern era. As a result of that, the OECD doesn't look at funds as being, you know, a vehicle of tax evasion or a vehicle of base erosion and profit shifting, and accordingly funds themselves are not a target of a lot of this regulatory pressure. So the fact of the matter is that, you know, fund management companies becoming a target of OECD pressure and the economic subsidy regime and all of that shouldn't really come as a surprise to anybody. But there's no real basis for anybody to have any concern whatsoever that sort of angst is going to be directed towards offshore funds. It just doesn't make sense.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think where we've come out is, if you're running a hedge fund, the offshore manager has come out of the structure, and with increasing speed now that they're going through regulatory audits by CEMA with increasing regularity. In the PEVC crypto space, there may well be cause to use the BVI approved manager, but more often than not, we would advise the use of a GPLP structure with some additional structuring to protect the assets and liabilities of the GP, guarding them against being a deep pocket of the partnership. In this way, we're future-proofing the structure of the fund and the asset manager, where a health warning really needs to go hand in hand with anyone setting up that BVI-approved manager. Great. Well, that's been a really good conversation. Thank you very much. And I guess that's a wrap for offshore management companies for the time. Mark and I are partners in the Hong Kong office of Appleby. We've been practicing law for more than 20 years, and we've been offshore for around 15. In this time, we've seen a lot, and we've each assisted navigating our clients through the dot-com bubble as junior lawyers, SARS, the GFC as senior lawyers, and now through COVID as partners. If you have any questions, we'd be delighted for you to touch base with us, and we'll catch you on our next conversation. Thanks for listening.